desire is that it's oftentimes not easy to fulfill, even though it's all around you offering itself, huh? Well, how many of you, question here for you, honest question, how many of you someday hope to get married? Someday. Come on, raise them up. Okay, every head bowed, and we're just going to do a matchmaking thing up here. No, that wasn't part of the price. How many of you hope that you will not only marry someday, but that you will be married to one person for your entire life? Okay, now you're in rather good company, because over the last 30 years, whenever pollsters have asked those two questions, how many of you would like to marry someday, and how many of you would like to spend the rest of your married life with one person, 90% of all Americans have always affirmed yes. Okay, for over 30 years, there has been no change in this kind of central conviction that marriage is still something that people want and that they would like it to last forever. Of course, the desire to be loved and to find a faithful lover isn't just an American dream. It, in fact, is a desire that is so universal that it, in fact, can be found in all cultures, and it supersedes any of the normal kind of social, economic, racial, gender distinctions that we might want to associate with most questions. Now, the same studies that ask these questions about do you want to and would you like to be married to one person all your life went on and they asked the question, do you expect to spend your married life with one other person? At that point, where before 90% said they wanted to, when they asked the question, do you expect to, they found a huge difference between desire and expectation. The desire was 90%, the expectation was 50%. For over 30 years now, 50% of all Americans say they really want to get married and they want to stay married, but only half of those, a little more than half of them, actually think they will stay married and only be married to one person. Now, I think this is kind of painful, kind of like our Santa snowman up there, you know, is that there's something that you deeply want, and yet at the same time you live with the ambivalence, the feeling that you can't really get it or you can't really keep it. Now, stats would in fact bear out this kind of pessimistic view of love and sexuality and marriage. If you were to ask kind of by the numbers, how do Americans think and what do they experience, you'll see some of these as they come up on the screen. Some things you might not have known. Okay, so why don't you read the screens? Are you ready, Johnny? And we'll do a little bit of music that's fitting to the theme of hope deferred in the whole issue of marriage and staying married.
Problem is all inside your head, she said to me. The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. She said it's really not my habit to intrude. Furthermore, I hope my meaning won't be lost or misconstrued. But I'll repeat myself. At the risk of being crude, there must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free.
Let's repeat a couple of those stats you saw. Today in the U.S., somewhere between 30 to 40% of all new marriages fail. Of those who stay married, about half report that they're not happily married. So a little more than half stay married, and half of those aren't happily married. Makes you wonder what we're thinking about when we start doing seminars on marriage and sexuality and all that. What's happened in our culture, and you are the really the generation that has received the brunt of the impact, is that there has grown to be a deep cynicism about marriage, kind of a nervous ambiguity about sex, because as you saw, sex can kill. I thought it was an incredible stat that in 1950, 5 known STDs, and now literally 33,000 people a day are getting them. And so there's this enormous change in our views of sexuality. All the time, though, this cynicism, this ambivalence, this nervousness hasn't been able to put a mark on our desire for love or for marriage or for sex, as that goes. And so what we're dealing here is one of the most profoundly powerful motivations in the human experience. Now, the real challenge is what are you going to do as a young man or woman in terms of the way you think about sexuality and about marriage and all that? I think the cynicism can be seen in this next cartoon, in which our young man is proposing to his love, and for the sake of those on tape, he says, "I love you, Cindy. Will you marry me for a year or two?" You are the first generation who is being raised perhaps by parents who had prenuptial agreements. That is, they figured out how to dissolve the marriage before they were married. A kind of strange way to enter into a commitment that's supposed to be rooted in love, the most dynamic and most powerful of all the virtues, and that indeed states, even in the secular systems oftentimes, until death parts us. It's my assumption that none of you wants this kind of pain, that none of you would want your children to have this kind of pain. And for those of you who are experienced from the homes of broken marriages, you know that the pain is deep and long-lasting. And so it's our hope as a staff tonight that the things that we'll talk about will begin to help you think in terms of a Christian worldview about these important topics, and that perhaps will generate some interest in your ongoing study. Well, the challenge we face, I think, is to ask the question, how can we avoid adding to these horrible statistics of divorce and disease, cynicism and pessimism? How can we avoid the problem of pregnancy outside of wedlock, the problem and the challenge of divorce, the challenges that we all are aware of? Well, there's actually a movement you can join. It hasn't gained much steam, to be really honest, but it was reported about 10 years ago, and periodically there is a kind of follow-up report in Time and Newsweek and those types of magazines where some young singles, college-age, well-trained, bright types of people, had decided that it is so horrible out there in dating land, and even worse in marriage land, that the number of them had begun to seriously commit themselves to a lifelong commitment of celibacy and singleness. But we already asked you how many of you wanted to remain single the rest of your life, and I guess that's not going to be a very likely option for you. So I guess we best try to open our hearts and hopefully build into them the stuff that will help you better work your way through the dating game and will better help you divorce-proof the marriages that will come from that. Before we go very far, though, I thought it might be helpful to ask the question, what has caused this devastation to lasting love? How can it be that in a meager, 30 years or so, we have moved from where divorce was relatively seldom ever seen, where abortion was unknown of except in the back alleys by doctors at times making money that way, where STDs were a handful, etc. How have we moved from where we were? Some people call it the Leave It to Beaver generation, that is, not your parents, but your grandparents' generation. How have we moved from what they had built to what we have dismantled? I'd like to suggest that there are three things. One is the ongoing impact of the sexual revolution of the late 60s and early 70s, the free love movement. Of course, this sexual revolution was broader than just a revolution about sex. It, in fact, was an aggressive and has become a pervasive assault on traditional Judeo-Christian values in our culture. The Judeo-Christian understanding of love, marriage, and sexual restraint all came under attack by the hippie movement of the boomers in the 60s and 70s. And that attack, while no longer carried by long-haired hippie anti-war folk singing kumbaya, singing songs like Kumbaya, only related to the war, that what's happened now is it has gone mainstream in the boomer generation. And so your teachers, if they're of that generation, are oftentimes those who are conveying and promoting these kinds of ideas. That love can be free, that there doesn't need to be responsibility, that it isn't dangerous, the sex act is really just an act, etc. This has become so pervasive in our culture that today, instead of people dating, they just hook up. That is, they have random encounters in the tavern scene in which the end result and perhaps even goal in going was to simply have a random sexual experience. This is all the outworkings of the sexual revolution and the abandonment of Judeo-Christian values. A second thing that intermixes with it, adds to it, and gains power from it, I suppose, as well, is the ongoing impact of what I'd call social Darwinism. Now, I'm not talking about the rigid scientific stuff. I'm talking about the implications we draw from it and then promote into the culture. Now, this has been happening ever since Darwin happened. It has happened in ways that at times have been somewhat beneficial and other times have been rather horrific. It is a well-documented fact that both the communist movement and Hitler's Nazi movement both drew part of their justifications for their oppression and persecution of certain people groups back to the issue of survival of the fittest, drawing it from Darwin. What has happened in social Darwinism in our culture is that there has been an aggressive attempt to reduce human nature to being no more than the top level of the food chain in the animal kingdom, the smartest of all the apes, but still just a primate, just an animal. This kind of thinking is carried all over the place, if you read broadly, not only in biology, but in its related interactions at times with psychology. But I was a little bit surprised to read the quote in the Western Front recently, made by a biology professor, Professor Don Williams, in which he's quoted as saying, "Staying together with one person for an extended period of time is not natural." So I'd like to suggest to you that your desire to have one mate for the rest of your life puts you, at least in Dr. Williams' view, as being unnatural. The male strategies to impregnate many women to produce offspring, Darwin's, survival of the fittest, comes through, dispersion of the gene pool. So he says that's the male strategy. A female, no matter how promiscuous she is, can only have one offspring a year. Thank God I'm a man. A male has no limit to how many women he can impregnate. To biologists, this is as clear as glass. That variety seeking, read multiple sexual partners, is part of the genetic machinery of the male. Now, this, of course, is a very convenient balm for the guilty conscience of predatory males in the university setting. I did find it ironic that he thought young males were more likely to be noble and committed to one mate than would older males. I don't know how old Mr. Williams is. It'd be interesting to have a conversation. But his view is that there is kind of an assaging for our guilty conscience, because really this is how we're hardwired, in his view, of extrapolating Darwin's observations, putting them on to the human experience, and then saying this is the way it really is. So it's good news for the predatory male, but it's very bad news for women in general. And in fact, for anyone, male or female, who actually thinks that fidelity and a monogamous love is not only a human virtue, but it's an attainable human virtue at that. You can see if you had kind of, you know, mushy-headed students sitting in a class hearing this kind of stuff, full of their own hormones and full of their own aggression, how good this news might appear to them. But of course, if you use the jungle as your measuring stick, then we will soon return to the tooth and blood and claw of the jungle's ethic. You can lose a whole culture by believing something in a false way, by extrapolating it and applying it in a false commitment. And so for us, we have not only the kind of libertarianism of the hippie movement and the boomer movement, but we also have this kind of attempt to justify this drive and all from a biological perspective. At a less esoteric level, I think our culture is inundated with the idealization of romantic love. Now, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about that, because I have the feeling that's more street level where you live than some idea, esoteric idea, of whether we're all hardwired guys to be philanderers. This idea of the idealization of romantic love is promoted aggressively and carried forward by our music, by our movies, by our television programs, and by some magazines that are popular within the pop culture. Now, magazines, you have to be thinking of things like People, Cosmos, Self, that kind of thing. But there's all kinds of TV programs that play with this idealization of romantic love. The movies are absolutely inundated with it, at least that genre traditionally known as the chick flick. Our music, if you were listening when you came in, all we were playing was music that had this view of love, this kind of idealized romantic view of love. Now, I suppose it's kind of a bummer to come someplace and the first thing you hear is that maybe you shouldn't idealize love. You know, maybe it's just that old guy up there, and maybe he's so old and withered that he just doesn't remember what it was to be young and virile and attractive. That's not the case. I'm not young, but it's none of your business about the others, but let's put it this way. Life is good. Now, Americans have long been told, and in fact the majority, not only of the secular culture, but of the Christianized culture. I want you to hear this. Americans have long been told, not only in the secular culture, but in the sacred culture of the community of faith, that, and in fact I think the majority relentlessly hold on to this idea, that the only sound basis for marriage is the experience and presence of idealized romantic love. The reason Americans vote for who they do has to do with their wallets. But the reason Americans marry generally has to do with their emotion. Their emotion over and against any other test and measure. In fact, this kind of love is used to justify all kinds of things. It is used to justify, in my counseling office, adultery. It is used to justify divorce. How ironic, because it's what's used to justify marriage. It is used by Christians to justify abandonment of God's will, and it is generally believed uncritically in our culture. To speak against this romantic view of love is to somehow be against America, apple pie, and motherhood. This cultural myth, and it is a myth, and I hope we'll fill it with something, replace and fill your hearts with something much better, has assaulted you and I from the earliest points of our memory. Now, it has come to us in the most benign manifestations, which maybe is Lewis's whole point in dressing up the Queen of Narnia, who is the epitome of wickedness, as a stately, tall, slender, gorgeous witch who gives Turkish delight to children. We have all been raised on the Turkish delight of an idealized romantic love. Now, I don't think that this is the main conveyor of it, but it was certainly the place that I was first introduced to it. Of all the benign manifestations and place that it would come from, it came from Uncle Walt. This trusted, noble figure in our culture who every Sunday night my family would gather together around the television and we would watch the world of Disney, the wonderful world of Disney. Have you ever thought seriously about the movies you watch? I asked my daughter that one time and she says, "Oh, Dad." And I says, "What, honey?" And she says, "People don't go to movies to think." Which was a great discouragement to me, because everybody's got an agenda. Tell yourself that. Everybody's got an agenda. There is no movie that does not have an intent. And so we have to be awake intellectually to what we see. But as a little kid, you know, you just didn't really do a lot of analysis of Snow White. I mean, now as an adult, it's pretty fascinating. You know, there's this really good young-looking gorgeous chick, and she's living with seven guys. I mean, what kind of movie is this that we'd show our children anyway? And then there's, of course, Cinderella, in which, you know, you can be have really ugly stepsisters, and you can be really tattered but gorgeous, and eventually you get the prince. And there's even this amazing movie about an amorous relationship between a frog and a pig. I just think that's got to be sick and wrong. There's something wrong. Darwin would have never, ever found that on the Galapagos Islands. An amorous pig and a frog. Some of you will get it. It's Miss Piggy and Kermit. You know, come on. Come on, men and women. You know, the guys were a little behind because they've been watching Terminator, you know, but, you know, okay. Well, what are some of the characteristics of this idealized love? Between me and our next guest speaker, I want to give you some of the basic assumptions and some of the mythology that's working in this idea of romanticized love. First, this view of love is that it is a mysterious visitor. It appears out of nowhere, and it takes hold of you or I at the deepest levels of our soul, creating the deepest forces of desire and drive that the soul can experience. We might wonder if it's the Force. Should we trust it, Obi-Wan Kenobi? Should we just trust the Force? Or is it a form of witchcraft? I grew up on a song called Love Potion Number 9. And sometime you should listen to it, okay? Where this witch is putting together love potions. You know, actually, there are still cultures that do that, that create aphrodisiacs for people, you know. We just use a little blue pill. By the way, remember, it's the red pill, not the blue pill that gives you reality in life, okay? And so this mysterious visitor... You know, this is Calvin and Hobbes' take, though, on the whole thing. Calvin and Hobbes being a couple of the more philosophically astute cultural observers. And it is coming. Isn't it? Is it coming, John? There it is. Okay, can you see it? Okay, I'll have to read it to you then. Up at the top left. Calvin talking to his tiger buddy Hobbes. "What's it like to fall in love?" "Well," says Hobbes, "it's See, the object of, you see, the object of your affection walks in. First, your whole heart stills into, sinks into your stomach and splashes your innards. And the monster wants, I can't even see it. Oh, the moisture makes you sweat profusely. I got to get down here where I can look at it from an angle that it isn't. Profusely. This condensation shorts the circuits in your brain, and you get all woozy. Okay? You got it so far? Then what's that say? When your brain blows out altogether, your mouth disengages, and you babble like a cretin until when? She leaves. To which Calvin says, that's love? Hobbes says, medically speaking, heck, that happened to me once, but I figured it was the cooties. A mysterious visitor. The second thing we can say about this ideal of love is that one falls in love. There are all kinds of songs about falling in love. It's the handiwork of the demigod Cupid. Cupid, draw back your bow and let your arrow flow straight to my lover's heart, as one song writer put it. Love is not the subject of any kind of law of rationality. It has no human control. Love is something that happens to you. You fall into it. Of course, the problem with this view is that it's a bit like climbing into a hammock, I think. That if one isn't very careful, one can fall out of it. And in fact, one of the books back here has a whole chapter on how not to fall out of love. It's actually pretty good. You heard the song earlier on, there must be 50 ways to leave your lover. Oh, at least. And the most oftentimes quoted reason for the end of a marriage is they said, we simply have fallen out of love. We take this quite willingly in our culture as a reasonable understanding of the nature of love. This irrational visitor who appears mysteriously can then disappear in a twinkling of an eye, more like Tinkerbell than anything solid or dependable. A third aspect of it, of this love, is it has the power to not only undo the curse of singleness, but it can even raise the dead. So it becomes a direct competitor with the Christian faith itself. Now you might say, now come on, where is there any suggestion that true love can raise the dead? Snow White is raised from the dead. Remember all those dwarf guys, the little short guys with the tall chick thing? You know, I'm not sure what they're saying psychologically there, men. Okay? But they're all, you know, they're all weeping at her death because she ate the nasty witch's apple. And then along comes Prince Charming and lays a good sloppy one on. They swap a little. Well, he swaps spit with her dead lips, which has got to be really gross. Okay? You know, and what happens? She comes back to life, resurrected by the power of romantic love. I am willing to bet, if you are deeply honest with yourself, that there are recesses in your heart, just like there were in mine when I was your age. Young, befuddled by reality about love and romance and all that, in which I really thought if I could just find that person, my life would make sense. My life would get better. It would resurrect me out of the doldrums. Another idea in this ideal of love, and we've got a little film clip for you to show you it in action. I only tried to pick really serious films that I thought you might want to go and rent. But one of the ideas is that this ideal of romantic love is that it not only can raise you from the dead, but it is always heroic. It is always about a knight on a white steed galloping in to rescue you from some kind of dangerous, dastardly dragon or something. And so, here it is.
Wake up!
What?
Are you Princess Fiona?
I am. Awaiting a knight so bold as to rescue me.
Oh, that's nice. Now let's go!
But wait, Sir Knight! This beeth our first meeting. Should it not be a wonderful, romantic moment?
Yeah. Sorry, lady.
Hey, wait! What are you doing? You know, you should sweep me off my feet out yonder window and down a rope onto your valiant steed.
You've had a lot of time to plan this, haven't you?
But we have to savor this moment. You could recite an epic poem for me. A ballad? A sonnet? A limerick? Or something?
I don't think so.
Well, can I at least know the name of my champion?
Shrek.
Sir Shrek. I pray that you take this favor as a token of my gratitude.
Thanks.
You didn't slay the dragon. Unorthodox, I'll admit, but thy deed is great and thine heart is pure. I am eternally in your debt. And where would a brave knight be without his noble steed?
All right, I hope you heard that. She called me a noble steed. She think I'm a steed.
The battle is won. You may remove your helmet, good sir knight.
No.
Why not?
I have helmet hair.
Please, I would look upon the face of my rescuer.
Oh, no, you wouldn't, Durst.
But how will you kiss me?
What? That wasn't in the job description.
Maybe it's a perk.
No, it's destiny. Oh, you must know how it goes. A princess locked in a tower and beset by a dragon is rescued by a brave knight. And then they share true love's first kiss.
Hmm? With Shrek? You think... Wait. You think that Shrek is your true love?
Well, yes.
You think Shrek is your true love?
What is so funny?
Let's just say I'm not your...
Shrek's one of my favorite movies because it's honest. You notice it's not made by Disney. Okay. So it's all wrapped into the romantic ideal, this heroic savior, this somebody who's going to come and transform your life, maybe raise you from the dead, but certainly offer you true love's first kiss. Finally, this kind of cultural view of romantic love states that it creates marriages, but they're made in heaven. It even asserts a kind of divine affirmation of it. Now, this is where a lot of times not only do Christians, because they're not necessarily thinking very much or because they've experienced the same hormonal passions that everybody else does or because they're inundated by the media as much as anybody else, kind of falls to this general kind of love. But when you get to this idea it's made in heaven, then the Christian really starts getting out and marching with the band. But I'd like to suggest to you a quote by C.S. Lewis who offered this keen insight. Lewis said, "If love is made in heaven, and in light of some of God's matches, It leads one to wonder if heaven is being run any better than things are run down here. 50% divorce rate. Highest divorce rate in America, I'm told by the pollsters, is in the conservative South amongst conservative Baptist Christians. Highest in the culture. If love matches leading to marriage are God's matches, then Lewis wonders, are things being run up there just as poorly as they are down here? Let's hope not. I'd like to turn this over to our guest. Where is our guest? There he is. Dress him up here. Hang on a sec.
Boy, that was not a very dramatic entrance, was it? Well, we're gonna have to do another take on that, guys, I'm afraid. I am the Doctor of Love. That's what I've been called. I don't know who called me that. I don't know if it was my wife. You'll have to ask her. But somebody called me that. And, all that money in this building and...
Yeah, I only did it once,
Dave. Okay, I must not have been there. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Okay. Well, you saw my quotes there of my fans, and so hopefully you can be added there to that list. John Travolta, Madonna, and Johnny Depp, all those great guys. Okay. So I'm here. We're here tonight to kind of dispel some myths. Brady kind of set up this whole notion of romanticized love, and. I called it the five myths of romanticized love, but I thought about calling it five stupid things people think about romantic love, but that sounded a little harsh. So I decided not to call it. We'll just call it the five, we're going to look at five myths of romantic love. Because if we can look through and see the myths of love and not be duped by them, we might be able to find real love. That's kind of the goal. So I, with my wide viewing audience and fan club, I have some questions that we're going to use to kind of kick off these. So we'll look at five questions that each kind of reflect one of the myths, and then we'll address it. So, and these questions will be up there. So the first question is up there, Dr. Dave. How can I know that the guy I'm dating is the perfect one God has picked out for me? I don't want to miss the man made in heaven for me. Molly made in heaven. Okay, so Molly, we're going to try to answer that question for you. I call this myth, there's only one out there for me myth, a.k.a. the perfect match myth. And this myth says that out of all the people in the world, there's only one person especially designed for you. And your mission in life is you have to go and you have to find them. Now, as most of us here, I'm assuming, are Christians, we tend to dress this up with spiritual lingo. So we can look at Genesis. We have our example there of Adam and Eve. And remember how God put Adam into a deep sleep, and then he took, the story says he takes one of Adam's ribs out, and he forms a woman out of that. And so now there's this idea that guys are out there looking for their missing rib. Now, it isn't a big barbecue we're looking for, although some guys, you might think that. They're looking for that perfect one that's going to fit perfect right alongside them. It's kind of Cinderella glass slipper with a little, twist, okay? So we can spiritualize this, and we're great at doing this. I just want to challenge that thinking tonight. That might disturb some of you, but that's okay. We're here to rattle some cages. First of all, I want to say, kind of to qualify some things I'm going to say, it doesn't mean that God doesn't care who we marry. He cares very profoundly. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But this idea that there's only one out there for me myth, I think we need to challenge that. I think there's some problems with that. One of the problems with that is I don't think it's very biblical. Unless you're Adam and Eve, if you were Adam and Eve, you could say that is very true. There was only one person made for me. And it would make dating life so simple because there's only one person there. And it's a real bummer if she says no, because then you're really up a creek, okay? But for the rest of us people there's people all over that potentially could be possible spouses for us. Here's what the scripture says. And this is the Apostle Paul writing in 1 Corinthians 7. He says, and he's speaking to women whose first husbands have passed away. He says, she, any woman, is free to marry anyone she wishes. Whew, that's good news, huh? But he must belong to the Lord. The scripture gives us a scary amount of freedom. A scary amount of freedom. And hence, there's a call that we should have a great amount of wisdom in this selection process. But we're given great freedom as to who we will marry. So it isn't necessarily a very biblical idea, this one made in heaven for us. Also, I think it puts enormous pressure on us. You have to find this person. You got to hope they live in the Western Hemisphere. It would be better and even more ideal if they actually went to Western. You got to hope they don't get killed. You got to hope that person will wait for you. Or that you can wait, and you got to hope when you ask them that they'll say yes and not no. If they don't, then you're left with second or third best, and that's kind of a bummer. So there's this pressure. You got to find this person. Is this the one? And then I think there's also a dangerous assumption. If I find this person, because it's made in heaven, then I'm guaranteed happiness. I think as Christians, we assume I find somebody and they're a Christian and the circumstances seem to fall into place, then we assume it's all God's doing. We equate our feelings with the voice of God. And so it must be made in heaven, and so it must be a good match. I think that can lead to not working very hard at a relationship. We don't want to test it. I mean, why? Why test what is obviously from God? We don't need to go slow, see if this person has basic life skills, like they can get out of bed and comb their hair, like they can do a checkbook, they have similar value systems, how many kids do they want, all that kind of boring stuff, because this is made in heaven. And that kind of thinking makes for poor matches. And the scary news is that God won't intervene. He won't send a big sheet down out of heaven saying, this is a bad match. He may have people in your life saying that, and you would be wise to listen. And then, along with this thinking, if you go ahead and get married and then you're unhappily married, you must conclude that you did not find the right person. And so now you live a life of regret, second-guessing yourself, realizing I picked the wrong person, and it opens the door to really profound temptation. What happens if you bump into somebody you think, now that's the one I was supposed to marry? Shoot, I didn't marry them. Lastly, in this myth, I think it can lead to using God's name in vain. Now, we usually think of using God's name in vain, we think of swearing, cussing. But using God's name in vain can be attaching, saying God is behind this idea, this notion. Take our infatuated feelings, smuggle God into it, smuggle our bad theology into it, and then you'll get a kind of line like this. And I don't know if this has ever been thrown upon you. God told me, you're the one. Now, if that's ever happened to you, especially you ladies, I'm going to give you, this is what you should just put this in your head. This is how you're going to respond to that, okay? We should have had it on the screen, but I didn't have it on the screen. Well, he didn't tell me, bub. And until he does, and until you can get your theology straight, I suggest you zip it and quit using God's name in vain. Right there. That'll put the end to the conversation. When I thought about marrying Shelley, my wife, I didn't say, God told me you're the one, because he didn't. God said that I was free to ask her, and then reminded me that she was also free to say no. And so there's always a little bit of risk there. The choice was up to me, it was up to her. So the truth is that there are many people that you could marry. Isn't that good news? There isn't just one person. There's many people you could marry and have a happy and fulfilling marriage with. Now, there are some that wouldn't be as good a match and others that would be a better match. So there's lots of people. I think that's good news. I don't know if you think that's good news, but I think that's good news. Okay. All right, myth. Let's go to our second question. Is it up there? Yeah. Dr. Dave, my girlfriend is really conservative. Can you say from the Victorian era when it comes to the physical aspect of our relationship? She's always putting the brakes on. How can we really grow in our intimacy if she's always putting the kibosh on the physical thing? Isn't that a great... That's from Lust-Laden Lenny. Thank you, Lust-Laden Lenny. This fits into our second myth, which is physical involvement equals relational intimacy myth. Another way of putting this myth is if I can get close and feel close physically with this person, then I am truly relationally close to this person. Now, before we go any further, I want you to hear what I'm going to say right now. That God is not against sex. That, in fact, he thought of it. Did you ever stop to think that he could have created far less exciting ways for us to procreate? That means to have children, for those who don't know what that word means. He could have thought, hey, if a man and a woman will mix their earwax on the end of a Q-tip, children will spring forth. And that could have been it. But instead, he had this ingenious idea that we call sex. So God is all for it, obviously in the context of marriage. Sexual intimacy in the context of marriage is meant to be an expression of real love. It's meant to deepen intimacy and unity. It can serve all kinds of functions in a marriage. And it's an expression that of love that's open to all who have proven their love by making a lifetime covenant to one another called marriage. Now, the problem with seeking sexual encounters before marriage are numerous, and we could have a whole time on that. I'm just going to highlight a couple, not even necessarily the most important. But one, I would say, is that it masquerades as real intimacy. It can feel like the real thing, like this is real intimacy going on. But I'd want to have you put in your head it's not. It's a pretender. It creates an illusion of the real strength of love in a couple. Creates an illusion, but it's just a pretender. An analogy I like to think of is when there's over-physical involvement in a relationship, it's like a couple seeing a lake that's covered with ice, and they think it looks strong enough for them to walk on, and so they begin to walk out on it. It has the illusion it can support them. But sexual encounters are real thin. They weren't intended to support the weight of a real relationship, to be the only thing that sustains that. And so, of course, then the ice cracks and the people fall through and it's all a mess. Because God never intended real intimacy to be built off of the physical sexual expression alone. And that's why there's so many divorces, as Brady was talking about. That's why, interestingly enough, there's a higher rate of divorce among people who live together before they're married. It's the great myth out there that living together to be find out if you're sexually compatible will really help a relationship. Actually, it hinders it. Because what it says is that sexual compatibility is the foundational issue. And that's what really makes a marriage or a relationship strong. But in fact, it isn't. I'd say another problem with this is that it clouds objectivity. When you're trying to think about a person you want to spend the rest of your life with, you want to be very clear in your thinking, don't you? I mean, think about how much time you take if you're going to buy a car or buy, I don't know, a computer or something. I mean, you kind of try to think it through a bit. Yet some people allow themselves to get very clouded by indulging in too much physical expression. I liken it to you're going into your final exam and you need to have a clear head. And so you think to help you think clearly and recall everything, you get high. You take some drugs. Because it makes you relax, right? And of course, you're so out there tripping along that you can't really remember anything, but you sure feel good while you're taking the test. Oh, you know, I can't remember that, but it feels so good. And whoosh, you turn it in, you're smiling at the prof, and oh, it's so good. Of course, you fail when you get your exam back, but you felt good at the moment. And that's what sexual adventurism before marriage can do. It can cloud objectivity. Because we've got to be honest. What's easier? To kiss and make out or to have heart-to-heart talks and work through conflict and talk about such exciting things as a person's economic worldview and how many kids they want to have and who's going to do the dishes and all those kinds of things. Well, it's a lot easier, a lot funner to kiss and, you know, do all that kind of stuff, right? So we get muddle-headed. There's a great quote from a musical, Fiddler on the Roof, talking about what romantic love, how can skew clear thinking. At one point, Tevye, the main character, says, "A bird may love a fish, but where will they build a home together?" I love that quote. It's a great quote. Where would they build a home together? It wouldn't work. I don't care how much the salmon loves the eagle. It's just not going to work. I mean, we've got to think objectively here, folks. And then lastly, in this myth, the importance of sexual experience in marriage is highly overrated. I mean, you got to think about it. The actual amount of time, I mean, you probably can think about it because you're not married, but those of us who are married can think about this. The actual amount of time making love when married, easily under 1% of married time together. Easily under 1% of married time. Except maybe on your honeymoon, and then it'll, of course, will go up a bit more, okay? If you can't find joy and pleasure in your relationship without unleashing the hormones and sexual activity, you're in trouble and you're not ready for the reality of married life together. So if you're dating right now, ask yourself, how much are we dependent upon physical expressions of love to make us feel close? The higher that goes up, the less ready you are to be married. Ooh, tough stuff. Okay, let's go to the next one. Next question. All right, Dr. Dave, I'm engaged to this guy, and he's real nice and all, but he does have a bad temper, and he can be kind of rude to me in public, and he does tend to tip a few too many with the guys, and although he has finally held a job down for a couple of weeks, should I go forward with it? I mean, marriage will mellow him out and make him more responsible, won't it? Signed, Naomi, I'm naive. All right. I'll call this myth magic moments at the altar myth. And this is the view that the wedding ceremony at the altar will indeed somehow miraculously, magically alter a person's basic personality and their value system. Somehow there's hocus pocus when the priest or the clergy, the pastor, says the words, and now I pronounce you man and wife. It can sound like this. He's disrespectful and insensitive, but that will change. He'll become a wool sweater-wearing, reflective, thoughtful guy who writes poetry and writes love ballads to me daily. Or, sounds like this, she's kind of critical and a bit nagging and a nasty sort of person, but that will change. Eventually, she'll only point out her weaknesses and not mine. Or this one, he's a slob, wears the same pair of underwear for a week, then throws it on the floor, and 2 weeks later forgets that it was dirty and wears it again. But that will change. He will become a masculine version of Martha Stewart. Or, she's a social animal, loves to be around people, have them over, dinner parties, all that stuff. But that will change. She'll be more like me. We'll read lots of books together, keep quietly to ourselves, and our house will be like a library and a monastery. But people think that all the time. They think that all the time. Somehow, when we get through the ceremony, it's all going to be different. So three things we need to realize with this myth. The first one is that while there is room for growth and change, and especially as Christians, we do realize that we are being changed, and we have that hope that Christ is changing us through His Spirit, we need to also realize that our basic personality types, with all the strengths and weaknesses that come with them, all of our likes and dislikes that come with them, are fairly static. Pretty much the same. The extrovert will not magically become an introvert. The firstborn leader is not going to somehow become very passive and allow another person to always just be the leader. The unemotional person will not instantly turn into an expressive Italian, throwing their hands up in the air and hugging everybody and crying at the drop of a hat. And it's probably a really foolish endeavor to think that you can change a person. We can hardly change ourselves, right? So I don't hold out a lot of hope of trying to change another person. The second thing we need to realize is that we constantly fight relational entropy. Entropy is that process of slowing down and decay of something. And relationships that are not constantly, diligently worked at tend to decay. If there is no diligence in them, they tend to suffer isolation, a lack of intimacy. So if they're not good signs of working hard at a relationship, growing at it while you're in courtship or dating, you know, I really don't give it a snowball's chance and you know where of it happening after you're married. And this kind of leads to the third thing we need to realize about this myth. We dress up for the hunt. Seems a little crude, I realize, to put it that way. But while we're courting and pursuing someone, we dress up. We put on our best clothes, our best behavior, right? We put our best foot forward. We're going to impress them. So the guy that normally sits around the table and lets a big burp out after meal probably will try to constrain himself a little bit, unless he's feeling very liberated and really wants her to know what he's like. And he may be more healthy at that point, lets her know what she's getting in for. But it isn't always the true person. Sometimes you see that where a Christian will foolishly date a non-Christian, and the non-Christian knows supposedly how important the Christian faith is to that person, and so they'll act the Christian part in order to influence and say, see, I'm really, I think I'm a Christian now. But it's only for the hunt. It's only till the prey is captured, and then they'll go back to being themselves. I remember a point when Shelley and I were first dating, and very early on, and I was over at her house, and she was making cheesecake for dinner. And she made it, and I ate it, and I raved about it and said how good it was. Flash forward about a year or so, and we've been dating, you know, for that long. She started making cheesecake again. And I hadn't even remembered this first time. I said, cheesecake? Oh, I hate cheesecake. And she looked at me and said, what? Last time you raved about it and said it was so good. Deer in the headlights kind of look, oh, I'm getting creamed right now. You know, I had captured her heart, was secure in it, and the real me was shining out. So a key here, if you're dating, date for a very long time. And then watch them and observe them. I mean, I'm not saying put little spy cameras in their house or anything creepy like that. But watch them, especially when they're not with you. Because that's who they really are. Here's the key principle out of this myth. Don't marry a person on the basis of what you hope they will become. Marry a person on the basis of who they are. And expect them not to change and maybe to not even be quite as nice as they are at the present. Expect some surprises. What you see is what you get, so shop wisely. It's an as-is kind of deal. I love this one quote. It says, you should go into marriage, before your marriage, with both eyes wide open, so you know what you're getting into. Once you're married, you live out your marriage with your eyes half shut, learning to look over all those myriads of things that can become stumbling blocks or offensive or reasons to batter the other person. Okay, let's look at our next one. Dr. Dave, I grew up with a nasty father, and now I'm dating a guy who does lots of things that remind me of my dad. Is there a way I can work out my childhood angst via this dating relationship? Rochelle, the repeat. I would put this myth, I call this myth, history won't repeat itself myth. Okay? And this really, I would say, aka another myth, way to put it is the parent lookalike myth. And it's really an extension of the previous myth. And we won't dwell on this one too long, I'll just touch on it. But there's a scary reality that often happens that victims of abusive relationships, maybe come from an abusive home, sometimes tend to marry people who will carry on that cycle of abuse, whether it's verbal, emotional, or physical. And it's really a nasty deal. The image I think of is a moth being drawn to a flame. Somehow there's this fatal attraction. They're drawn to that very thing that caused so much pain in them. And yet they repeat it. Often they'll repeat it over. They'll find Marion or date a person who kind of repeats that in their own life. And yet there's this naive hope that this cycle won't be repeated. We throw in some romantic feelings into the mix, and somehow it's going to be different, and we're going to be safeguarded from all the pain and from our old wounds. And I'm not a psychologist, not a counselor, so, you know, these are just my speculations. I'm sure you could read up and find, you know, much more that I'm going to say here, but you know, perhaps it could be an unconscious attempt to go back and recapture love that they never received from that parent, from that abusive person, vicariously through the person they marry, hoping it can be better the second time around. Or maybe it's an effort where they're trying to deal with false guilt they carry. My dad didn't love me. It must have been my fault. I'm going to try to work and do a better job. I'm going to marry somebody who's really similar and see if I can do a better job with it. When you say it out loud, it doesn't make any sense, but oftentimes these kinds of things move us unconsciously without us being even aware of it. In the end, whatever it is, it's an attempt to use a relationship as a means of working out the pain or guilt of childhood. And really, whatever the motives, whatever really is happening there, the key is to deal with hurt and pain of childhood before bringing that baggage into a relationship and into a marriage. The last thing you want to do is turn your relationship and or your marriage into one big therapy session where you're trying to work out your pain from the past. But it happens all the time, and it is disastrous for everybody involved. The key is to get healthy. If you've been injured, get help. And we really do hope our community will be a place for some of you who have that, that experience where you could begin to find healing and wholeness. The temptation is go to the romantic relationship. I would say go to your core. Be involved with real relationships here. Get some help. Talk to a pastor. If you do that, you're less likely to get into this kind of vicious cycle. You won't demand that the relationship cure you or fix you. And when you're in a better place, you'll actually have something to bring into the relationship rather than demanding that this relationship do something for me, helping me work through my issues. Okay? And the last one. Dr. Dave, should I drop out of school? I met this girl, and she's awesome. I can't concentrate on studies and end up missing most of my classes anyway because I'm hanging out with her. Friends say we have an unhealthy relationship, but I think we're just in love. Should I bag school for now so we can be together more? She's all I want or seem to need right now. Sincerely, Idolatry Ivan. Well, we'll call this last myth, the you're all I'll ever need myth. This is this person is in love so much that they think that the other person will sufficiently fulfill all their desires, needs, and wants, that they will never need anything or anyone again. Now, you'll know if you're trapped in this myth when some of the worship choruses we may sing Friday nights, you start slipping the person's name and a vision of them in the midst of the song. You know, draw me close to you, never let me go. Nothing else could take the place to feel the warmth of your embrace. You are my desire, nothing else will do. You're all I want, you're all I ever needed. And all of a sudden we move from worship into, oh, that kind of fits that person, doesn't it? You see it when people drop everything in life, kind of like our Ivan here. All their responsibilities, all their other relationships, they kind of drop them like a bad apple. And they devote all their time and energy to this new person. And so a world of 5 billion shrinks to a world of 2. And there's hardly, you know, can get anything or anyone in between that. Everybody else is just kind of a backdrop to this all-consuming relationship. The Bible has a term for this. It's called idolatry. Can you say idolatry? No, never mind. Okay? What's an idol? An idol, idols are anything or anyone that steals away our devotion and attention, ultimately away from God, but also away from other important, necessary relationships and responsibilities. And there is a nice little rule about this in your owner's manual, the Bible. It's called the First Commandment, and it says this: I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. And our culture has made a huge idol out of romantic relationships. It's a little deceptive because we don't carve statues in this culture, but we still make idols left and right. We just don't have, you know, actual things we bow down to. But romantic love is a huge idol in our culture. All kinds of relationships and responsibilities are abandoned in the name of falling in love, as Brady was talking about. Married couples will break their marriage vows for romantic relationships. Parents will abandon the responsibility to raise their kids in the name of romantic relationships. Pastors will torpedo entire congregations and their own calling for an affair, and people will abandon God. So it's pretty serious business, this idolatry. Besides these effects, I want to just end with two other effects that it can have, that creating an idol out of relationships can have on a couple. It can crush the other person, and it can disappoint ourselves if we find ourselves in that kind of relationship. Crushing the other person, the image I have it that helps me think about it is the image of picture a tree, if you will, picture snow coming down. It's a beautiful image. It's a beautiful thing to tell a person, at least it seems like it is, to say to someone you're in love with, you're all I really ever need. I mean, that's heady stuff. It's beautiful, you know, and the snow falls down. But the reality behind that, I would say, is the image of way too much snow falling down to the point where the tree starts to bend and to crack, and all of a sudden it is crashed and crushed. Idolized relationships are self-serving by nature, and they tend to pile up expectations on another person. You're all I need. Boy, if anybody ever tells you that, get out really fast while you're still standing and have your branches intact. Because really what that person is saying, you need to be God to me. You need to meet my needs, which, by the way, are eternal and endless and can only be met by an eternal God. And so I'm insatiable. I have more and more needs. And the snow falls and crushes the other person. It also, if you're that person who has those expectations, you're going to obviously be disappointed, right? Because you're always going to be let down by other people, because nobody can meet our deepest needs. Our deepest needs and drives for significance and intimacy, they can help, but they can't meet the deepest ones. You see it in people who have a string of relationships that have a quick, fast start. And boy, things seem, you know, hot and romantic, and they're just head over heels. And then 6 months later, wow, another one bites the dust. Boy, another relationship has crashed under the weight of this kind of expectation. And it leaves people crushed and leaves others feeling disappointed. So the key, if you find yourself there, is one, recognize and repent of idolizing images of romantic relationships. I would suggest you might need, as Brady was taking us, to fast from, we usually think of fasting having to do with food. You can fast from all kinds of things. You may need to fast from some Hollywood movies. Maybe don't see those kinds of chick flicks or things that feed that kind of desire. Marriage is a temporary state. I mean, it's a temporary state. I'm not going to be married forever. In heaven, I won't be married to Shelley. I'll be married to Christ. Sometimes you have to reorient and get a biblical vision of what's going on. So one, recognize, repent from Hollywood images of romantic relationships. And then two, and Brady's going to develop this much more in the sessions up ahead, spend more time trying to become the right person rather than trying to find Mr. or Mrs. Right. Worry about what kind of person you're becoming. What are you expecting of yourself to be? Can you be a kind of person that can be counted on, depended on, and will seek to serve and not be served? Will seek to try to meet expectation of others when legitimate and not have always your expectations met? So there you go. There are a few myths. I'd encourage you to take them, evaluate yourself on them. If you're in a dating relationship, see where you fall. And if you're not, then let them be a little safeguard as you think about the whole path of dating relationships. Thank you very much. My book will be coming out shortly.